Hello and welcome. You are tuned to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech Public Radio. I'm Brian Kennedy, and we begin the program with a roundup of the latest news. The government spokeswoman, Veronika Skoshepova, has resigned following reports in the Czech media that she had padded her official resume. She was the longtime assistant to the newly appointed Prime Minister, Jiří Paroubek, during his tenure as local development minister. Mr. Paroubek took office on the 25th of April, and Ms. Skoshepova assumed her new role just a week later. Czech media reported on Friday that she had exaggerated her academic credentials and listed work experience on her CV with at least one organization for which she had never worked. Ms. Skoshepova, a former journalist herself, said on Saturday that she had been the target of a negative media campaign, but denied that she had false information in her resume. She said she was only leaving her post as spokeswoman because she did not want to discredit the new government in any way. Former Czech President Václav Havel has signed on to an open letter attacking Russia's record on democracy and political freedom. The letter's 75 signatories include former prime ministers of Soviet bloc countries like Estonia, as well as advocates of democracy from Europe and the United States, including current and former lawmakers. The open letter is to be published in the UK's Financial Times newspaper on May the 9th to coincide with ceremonies in Moscow marking the end of the Second World War. Mr. Havel and other signatories accuse Russia of betraying the principles behind the victory against Nazi Germany some 60 years ago and say Russia's plan to mark the anniversary in Moscow makes a, quote, mockery of the struggle for freedom. Official commemorations marking 60 years since the end of the war continued here in the Czech Republic on Saturday, along with reenactments of several historical events, including the bloody battle on Prague's Vinohradská Street for control of what was then Czechoslovak radio. Among the bigger events planned for Saturday, President Václav Klaus will host a celebration at the Prague Castle honoring Czech veterans of the war. And finally, the weather. Partly cloudy skies, scattered rain and daytime temperatures in the low teens remains in the forecast over the next few days.
And now we continue with a special Radio Prague program to remember the 60th anniversary of the end of World War II. Tomorrow we'll be looking at the celebrations of the anniversary around the country, but in today's program we'll try to take a step back. There are two widely held stereotypes of Czechs during the war. While some see a plucky little nation that heroically struggled to survive under the Nazi jackboot, others have argued that Czechs buckled and failed to resist the force of Hitler's Germany. But inevitably, history is more complicated than the stereotypes, and in the course of today's program, we'll be trying to unravel some of these complexities. Tensions had been rising throughout the 1930s, with growing separatist tendencies among Czechoslovakia's German-speaking minority, who rallied around a man who took his inspiration from Hitler, Konrad Henlein. It was these pressures that led to the tragic events of 1938, when Britain and France gave Hitler the green light to annex Czechoslovakia's German-speaking border regions, a huge tract of the country. Dieter Asiedu now looks into the events of the time.
Czechoslovakia, 1938. The physical education teacher Konrad Henlein becomes the leader of the Sudeten German Party, a party formed by the large ethnic German minority that lived in the border regions, promising the 3 million Germans, which constituted some 23% of the entire Czechoslovak population, autonomy. Henlein soon became the mouthpiece of Nazi Germany in Czechoslovakia. Germany had already swallowed Austria in the Anschluss, and Adolf Hitler saw the Sudetenland as a gateway to a more ambitious plan, the occupation of Central Europe. Hubert Rybka, journalist, historian and political advisor to the Czechoslovak president, Edvard Beneš, described the political situation to shortwave listeners on August 30th, 1938.
Despite all this, we continue to believe that it is possible to avert a general catastrophe which would affect almost the whole world. Only recently, President Dr. Benesch again expressed his belief in the possibility of preserving peace when he told the American newspaper woman Leclerc the following: "I am fully convinced that peace in Europe can be preserved. I consider it my duty to try everything which would contribute towards peace. Personally, I will do everything possible. I continue in the hope that there will be no war. I am convinced that it will always be possible to prevent it."
On September 13th, violence and destruction broke out in the Sudetenland. Rebels besieged train stations, took control of local police stations, post offices, and Jewish shops and buildings. The wave of deep unrest left dozens dead. The Czechoslovak government reacted by declaring martial law in 8 districts in the country's border area. But Hitler declared he would no longer tolerate the discrimination of ethnic Germans in Czechoslovakia, claiming it was difficult to see how a general European war could be avoided. Czechoslovakia was a major arms manufacturer and had a very modern army of 25 divisions. If Hitler carried out his threat and German forces crossed the border, the Czechs would fight, and they thought they had the guaranteed support of the French and the Russians. Gordon Skilling was doing research on Czech history at the time and also working here at the radio.
We at the time thought that the resistance was possible and desirable, and in fact some of the Czechoslovak generals felt the same way, and some of the political leaders. We also hoped perhaps that the readiness to resist would deter Nazi Germany from attack. But I do remember a great mass meeting, a huge meeting of protest against Germany in Munich, at which leaders of the main pro-resistance parties, from the communists to the extreme nationalists, spoke. And that was an electric occasion because tens of thousands of Czech workers streamed in through the streets to this square. So there was a readiness to resist. The troops went off to the borders, and the planes were ready. But unfortunately, President Benesch decided to capitulate and to give way to the British and French demands.
Just 2 decades after the end of World War I, neither Britain nor France, still recovering from the war and marked by the world economic crisis of the interwar period, wanted another war. On September 29, 1938, representatives of the 4 powers, Great Britain, France, Italy and Germany, met at Munich to come to an agreement. Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, became the major spokesman for the West. Recognizing Hitler's claims for the ethnic Germans in Czechoslovakia as genuine, he believed that a war could be avoided if Hitler were appeased by promising him the Sudetenland. The Munich Agreement was signed, and the Czechoslovak government was neither invited nor consulted. The Czech border regions were ceded with Germany. Poland took the opportunity to annex the Jeszczyn region in the north, which had a Polish minority of 75,000, and Hungary annexed the southern part of Slovakia and Ruthenia, with a Hungarian minority of 750,000. Overnight, Czechoslovakia lost about a third of its territory, population, and most importantly, its military advantage. Its defensive frontier of both mountains and fortifications had been given away, and without it, the Czech army was worthless.
With Czechoslovakia left alone by its allies, resistance would have led to massive bloodshed. But should Benesch have decided to go to war anyway, knowing the huge number of Czech and Slovak lives it would have cost? The Czech historian Jaroslav Hrbek thinks so.
I'm of the opinion that it was a mistake not to fight even without the Western allies, and of course I'm supported by such authorities as Winston Churchill, who said that the public opinion in Britain would force the government to change the view towards Germany, and I'm of course supported by the last vote of the French government before Munich, when there was just a majority of 1 vote for those who wanted to seek an agreement, and the other half wanted to go to war. And among those who wanted to go to war was the Premier Daladier himself. So I would say it was a mistake. And from the moral viewpoint, it would be the right thing to fight, even without our allies.
After Munich, President Edvard Benesch resigned and went into exile in Britain, and Emil Hácha became president of the ragged remains of Czechoslovakia. The final nail in the coffin came on the 14th of March 1939, when Slovakia broke away and formed itself into a puppet fascist state. Emil Hacha was summoned to Berlin. Legend has it that Hitler reminded him of the beauties of Prague and told him what a shame it would be if the Luftwaffe had to flatten the ancient Czech capital. Hitler demanded that the Czech lands be incorporated into the Nazi Reich as a protectorate, which must be one of the most grimly inaccurate euphemisms in history. Hacha, it said, had a minor heart attack. A broken man, he capitulated.
Vložil jsem osud českého národa do rukou vůdce.
I have entrusted our country to the Führer and have been promised his trust, Hacha said on Czech radio. The swastika flew from Prague Castle and not a shot had been fired. All this is in sharp contrast with another enduring image from the time, that of the Polish cavalry less than 6 months later, heroically and vainly trying to resist German tanks. And it begs the question, could and should Czechs have shown the same kind of resistance? Jaroslav Hudbeck.
The comparison with the Poles is a little bit misleading. We must compare the Czechs with other nations, not with the Poles, which are, I would say, exceptional in their bravery, in their courage, and in their opposition towards the oppressors of all kinds during their history, the Russians and the Germans as well. The Czechs must compare themselves with other nations, let us say with the Danes, with the Dutch, with the small nations which were occupied by the German army, which were not pleased with the occupation, but which had to survive the occupation. And that was the basic problem of the majority of the Czech people, was just to survive the occupation, just to live through the war. And I would say that it is a saying that to survive the war, to survive the occupation, without damage to one's moral integrity, that was, I would say, a heroic deed in itself. There was something which not all of them managed to do, and it was something that one can be proud of, to keep his moral integrity.
Když dva se milují, štěstí jen svoje vidí, a srdce neošidí.
In the early days of the occupation, in some ways life went on as normal. The protectorate was a strange political setup. At one level, the Czech government remained in place. Even President Hacha was able to stay in office. And the protectorate had a degree of real autonomy. But on the other hand, the country had been incorporated directly into the German Reich and was directly subordinate to German laws. When Czech students protested against the occupation in November 1939, the protests were put down with guns. The student leaders were executed, dozens were sent to German concentration camps, and all Czech universities were closed for the duration of the war. In this strange schizophrenic situation, the role of President Hacha and Prime Minister Alois Eliáš was a deeply ambivalent one.
Eliáš, and to a lesser extent also President Hacha, tried not to sabotage, I would say, but to put the Czech nation first and the German efforts second. They tried to lead the Czech nation through the dangerous period and to save as much of the autonomy, to save the integrity of the nation.
The protectorate government was undeniably collaborationist, but at the same time, up until mid-1940, Prime Minister Eliáš was also in direct contact with the Czechoslovak government in exile in London and actively helped to conceal the activities of the underground resistance from the Germans. Economically, life in the protectorate went on pretty much as normal, and Czechs, unless they had the misfortune not to conform to the Nazis' insane laws of racial purity, were largely protected from the impact of the war. But the semblance of normality was superficial and short-lived.
Stráže u hlavního vchodu do Pražského hradu rovněž, kde na prvním hradním nádvoří, kde jsou vtyčen vlajky.
It is autumn 1941. We're in the outer courtyard of Prague Castle, the seat of Czech rulers since medieval times. Reinhard Heydrich is being installed as a deputy Reich protector, the man in charge of the occupied Czech lands. A military band strikes up the German national anthem. Reinhard Reinhard Heydrich was the architect and coordinator of the final solution that led to the murder of millions of Jews. He was also head of the security services throughout the Reich. He had long suspected Prime Minister Eliáš of contacts with the resistance and immediately had him arrested.
Že bývalý předseda protektorátní vlády Alois Eliáš byl prvním senátem lidového soudu pro nadržování nepříteli a přípravu velezrady odsouzen na smrt.
Here is the Protectorate Radio on the 2nd of October 1941 announcing that Eliáš has been executed for betraying the German Reich. To this day, Eliáš is a deeply ambiguous figure of Czech history, the collaborator who in the end gave his life for his country. Heydrich, as architect of the final solution, had his own special plans for the Czechs. His grotesque pseudo-scientific studies concluded that 45% of Czechs could be successfully Germanized, 40% were inferior mongrels, and 15% were racially intolerable. But Heydrich's reign was to be short-lived. His assassination was one of the most daring missions of World War II. Titled Anthropoid, the mission saw two Czechoslovak soldiers, Jan Kubiš and Josef Gabčík, trained in Britain, parachute into the Protectorate. Against almost impossible odds, Kubiš and Gabčík fatally wounded the Reichsprotector on the 27th of May 1942 as his car drove through Prague. The assassination had drastic consequences. Jan Wellinger tells the story.
Hudební četa vzdala poslední poctu tělesné stránce zesnulého zastupujícího říšského protektora.
A radio broadcast on the 5th of June 1942 announces the departure of Reinhard Heydrich's coffin from Prague's Bulovka Hospital, even as his assailants remained at large, anonymous and hidden, from the fury of the SS. Days after the attack, the assassins Gabčík and Kubiš were consumed by fear their operation had failed, that Heydrich would survive in hospital. They had no way of knowing that a spleen injury and infection would eventually lead to Heydrich's death. Military historian Jiří Reilich explains how their attempt had balanced on a knife's edge.
Původně bylo předpokládáno, že Heydricha zastřelí Gabčík ze Stenganu.
Originally it was planned that Gabčík would be the one to kill Heydrich with what was known as a Sten gun. But indeed the gun jammed at the fatal moment as Gabčík was getting ready to shoot Heydrich point blank. Kubiš, waiting nearby, then lobbed a small bomb at Heydrich's car. The Nazi ruler was injured, but would only die in hospital after 1 week.
Bylo nezbytně nutné vyklidit pole a nenechat se chytit.
The chaos following the attack saw the Czech assassins quickly go to ground, along with other parachutists in the country, on their own sabotage missions. While there was fear retributions would be great, in the end Nazi atrocities exceeded even the worst expectations. In unbridled fury, the village of Ligice was destroyed. The men shot, the women and children sent to concentration camps. But the butchery didn't end there.
It's true, no one foresaw just how extensive reprisals would be. In all, 5,000 people were killed.
Bylo zavražděno téměř 5,000 českých občanů.
Professor Erazim Kohák, whose father was in the resistance, was just a boy when Heydrich died. He says he'll never forget the mood that enveloped Prague.
Fear. Fear in the air, the shock and awe. Even children as I was were affected by it. Czechs were simply stunned.
Every day Prague's German radio announced the names of people executed in retribution, most of them chosen without reason.
Erstens. Benedikt Karel, geboren am 14.07.1911, wohnhaft Prag 11. Zweitens. Svoboda Vladimir, Doktor, Rechtsanwalt, geboren am 30.05.1900, wohnhaft Budweis.
There were also lesser-known consequences. Hannah Greenfield, a Holocaust survivor, remembers.
It's never been made public that also 1,000 Jews were killed as a reprisal for the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich.
As Czechs faced retribution at home, Heydrich's killing was hailed as a major triumph abroad, not least in London by Czech president in exile Edvard Beneš. Anthropoid had largely been his master plan in conjunction with British covert operations. The idea of killing a prominent Nazi official or a highly placed collaborator was central to Beneš's plans by 1941. The exiled president had been desperate to show the Allies that Czechoslovaks had not given up. And he had good reason. For many in the countries still fighting Germany, Czechoslovakia had ceased to exist after Munich in 1938. Some historians say that Beneš was obsessed that even if the Allies won the war, Czechoslovakia would never regain its former borders and would remain forever a rump state. Professor Erazim Kohák again.
It seems to me the longer I look back, the more it's clear that it was the crucial turning point, the one place where we managed to cancel the Munich Agreement. It was after the assassination of Heydrich that the Allies recognized Czechoslovakia as fighting ally and not simply as a victim whose pieces would have to be picked up after the war.
Historian Jiří Rajlich agrees the assassination was key to changing Brits' and other allies' minds.
Remember, no other resistance movement in occupied Europe proved capable of assassinating such a high-standing Nazi official. In all respects, the killing of Heydrich, the head of the security forces, one of the most important men in Nazi Germany, was an extremely significant event. It didn't go unnoticed abroad.
If that was a turning point politically, it was also a controversial one with the vicious reprisals that inevitably followed. Was the killing of Reinhard Heydrich, to put it bluntly, worth the terrible price? The massacre of Legice, the killing of hundreds in the resistance movement, the arbitrary executions.
Ve skutečnosti tady existoval vyšší princip.
What was at stake here was a higher principle. The same principle led Czech soldiers to join armies abroad or to fight in the underground at home. By my account, some 10,000 Czechs were killed. They could have stayed home and done nothing at all. By definition, they didn't have to fight.
If there is today a Czech nation, we owe it to the people who fought and sacrificed then.
The Heydrich assassination was the most conspicuous act of Czech resistance. But compared with some countries of occupied Europe, active resistance in the Czech lands was very limited. While the number of Czechs in the resistance at home was small, the numbers fighting the Germans from armies abroad was far bigger on both the eastern and western fronts.
The fact that the Czechs were fighting in the Battle of Britain and later in North Africa was of great importance to the Czech government in London in their discussions and trying to secure the independence of the Czechoslovak government and its place in, among the Allied nations. The same was true on the Eastern Front, vis-à-vis the Soviet government and vis-à-vis Stalin personally. After the first battle of the Czechoslovak battalion, then in a very important battle of Kharkov, it was very well received by the Soviet authorities that the Czechs, even in just the battalion strength, are helping the Red Army to win the war.
Voláme všechny Čechy, přijďte nám i hned na pomoc. Voláme všechny Čechy.
The last major conflict in Europe at the end of World War II was the Prague Uprising, which began right here in the Czech radio building. At the time, Hitler was already dead. The hammer and sickle was flying over Berlin. But the German army of occupation was still holding out in Prague. On the 5th of May, the people of Prague took up arms to liberate themselves.
There's Prague, there's Prague. Americans and English, help us. We need guns. There are too many Germans. Send us airplanes and tanks. The Americans before Pilsen sent us airplanes too. The Germans are coming from south, north, west and east. Help us, help us.
Over 2,000 Czechs lost their lives in the street fighting that ensued. But they really did manage to liberate not just Prague, but also a considerable part of central Bohemia. With Germany's war machine already shattered, it would have probably made little difference to the war and saved many lives if the people of Prague had just sat and waited. So was the sacrifice worthwhile?
I think it was, because it was just the thing the moral of the nation needed, to show to themselves that they were able to resist, and they were able to fight actively against the Germans. In that sense, I would say that those 2,000 dead in Prague made the sacrifice to a right cause and helped to restore the morality and the self-assurance of the nation.
In the course of the war, it's thought that over 150,000 Czechs, half of them Jewish, lost their lives. It is hard to speculate what if, whether the Czechs should have fought after Munich, whether the resistance could have done more, whether non-Jewish Czechs could have done more to help their Jewish neighbours. The war left a complex legacy. But I think it's easy to understand the sense of pride with which many Czechs are celebrating the anniversary of the end of the war this weekend. You've enjoyed this programme. Tune in again tomorrow as we'll be reporting on events to commemorate the anniversary around the country. From me, David Vaughan, and all of us here at Radio Prague, goodbye.